is one in which I'm involved. I have to say, I've historically not had journal club discuss articles in which I'm involved mostly. I don't enjoy the spotlight. But this one was special and involved the entire pulmonary and cardiac, which constitute the heart and lung transplant group. And it was a large endeavor, and it was probably one of the most meaningful changes in my practice. Where I felt I had the most impact on patient care, actually. So I wanted to share this with you all. I know at Michigan, you do also have the opportunity to see patient face to face. So certainly curious to see how you all do it. But basically, the story starts kind of many years ago, 2017, I want to say, when Joe had an interaction with transplant coordinators and found out that some patients did want to see their organ after transplant. They were intrigued by it, and transplant coordinators would then call our tissue registry and get the bags of formalin with the organs inside that were chopped up, and they were trying to show to patients through the bag of formalin that was by then probably a little murky and try to kind of explain what was going on with their organs. And they did it because this group of, well, I would say that all our clinicians are devoted and all our clinical team are devoted to their patients, but transplant coordinators do have a special relationship with these patients because of the nature of their disease and their clinical course. So they did it, but they didn't really particularly enjoy doing it or felt comfortable doing it. So when Joe found that out, he kind of offered them to see if he could do something on the pathology side and explore a way where we as pathologists, which is we are the natural people to actually do this, we feel comfortable with organs and feel comfortable talking about diseases. And so that was our journey, which we call On My Path, where by which we established with the help of the autopsy team, why autopsy team? We had already a great setup. We already were cutting all the heart and lung explants at our autopsy heart and lung cutting. We had a viewer room, and that's what you see on the top picture here. Because we are also an ME office, when we remodeled, we had created a viewing room in case patients or families would need to view bodies. But it was not very used. So we took opportunity of this viewing room to use it as a site to meet with patients. The other thing that Joe and Melanie had started is to do 3D scanning of organs, and we thought it would be a great opportunity to use that as a way of gifting patients with a copy of their diseased organ to remember this event and to have a way of showing to other family members their organs. So basically, the way it works is transplant coordinators try to set up appointments with our secretaries to find a time on the calendar. And our PRS, our autopsy time, autopsy team is notified of that appointment. They're the one who pull the organs from TR, clean them, scan them, order 3D printed, and set up the room. And at the time of the meeting, the patients, their family, sometimes we had up to 10 people kind of gather in the room where we have a computer. So if we need to show microscopy, we can. And when we first meet, the curtains are closed, and we kind of just introduce ourselves to family members, talk to them about what a pathologist is. Some people had never heard really of pathologists or don't really know what a pathologist is and does, and then kind of talk to them about what they're about going to see, what their experience is. And typically, what we do is we always have a normal for control for them to see first. So we actually start with the normal and kind of explain them the normal anatomy, what a normal organ should look like, and then uncover the slices of their disease organ and go about explaining to them their our disease organs. And that's kind of always like a great moment for patients. They get to take pictures, videos, hold the organs, tell their story. And then by the time we're done, we gift them with a copy of their organs. We have our pathology report and our cards if they ever want to get in touch with us again. So that's kind of in a nutshell how we meet with patients and discuss with patients. And basically, this is kind of the setup of our abnormal organs with our normal model. This is our 3D setup and how we do our 3D scanning and our printing of organs. And basically, the pandemic was a hard moment for everybody, but including for our program. Initially, we had progressively grow. So the in blue are the bars of how many transplant there was, and in red was how many patients were viewing their transplant. And from 2017 to 2019, we had grown a lot of our viewings to the point that the majority of patients that were transplanted were viewing their organs. But when the pandemic hit, we kind of went backwards a bit. What was interesting is the transplant took off. So there's many more transplant, especially the pulmonary program really took off. They hired more surgeons. So we have a lot of transplants now in lung as well as heart. By the time we wrote the paper, it took a while before it got published. As you can see, I don't have the most recent data. Right now, it's about 20-30% of patients that view their organs, but it's increased since 2025. We're getting closer to 50-60% of patients that do ask. And we don't, it's offered to them by the transplant coordinator, and they opt in or not. But more and more are opting in. And we have another study coming out that Anya led. That was a qualitative study where patients were officially interviewed about their experience. In this paper, we mostly surveyed the transplant coordinator. They're the closest to the patient. So at the beginning, the transplant coordinators, all of them came with the patients and actually themselves assisted to the viewing. So they all understood what we were doing with the patients. I think there was some nervousness from the clinical team. They were afraid that pathologists were meeting patients. Like, we can't talk to people. I don't know. So there was a bit of an interesting reaction at first. But the transplant coordinators were kind of curious about what we were doing. And after a while, they stopped coming. But we did survey them about what they thought the experience was for patients. Certainly, they were happy not to have to do it anymore. They were very satisfied that they were getting a much better experience with the patients. And the feedback they were getting from the patients was that it was extraordinary. So one of the transplant coordinators used the word priceless for our patients. We had gotten some spontaneous feedback from patients that we included in this paper, and for them it was an amazing opportunity, a beautiful gift, and that's been my personal experience doing these with patients. I have seen shed many of tears myself, have been choked up and tearing. It's profound experience. It's often an opportunity for them to have a closure, an understanding of the disease. These patients, when they show up at the clinic to get their lung transplant, they're on the at the edge of death, basically. And everything is about their care, keeping them alive until they get their organs. And when they get their organs, it's not an easy surgery, it's not an easy process, the rehabilitation and so forth. So all the focus is I know I have a bad heart. I know I have a bad lung, but that's all I know because everything else is keep me alive and then bring me back with my new organ. So meeting with us is their very first moment where they really can dive into understanding their disease better, understanding how bad it was, and seeing it for themselves. I think that's very powerful. They know. They seen X-rays or CT scans or and so they know their organ and bad, but being able to see what a normal should look like and how bad theirs is very often a moment of opportunity. There's an opportunity. They often thank their old organ, saying thank you for having kept me along alive so long, but also a moment of gratefulness for their new organ and the opportunity to a new life. So for me, it's been an extremely meaningful experience, life-changing. For them, for patients, there's no doubt that it's very impactful. Our trainees also, I'm glad we usually have our fellows participate. We've had visitors come, and they're always blown away by this because it's just not a routine part of our practice. But I would say if anybody has any opportunities to do that in their practice, they should take and embrace it. It's not easy. It is disruptive in your day because it's just not part of what we do. We're not sitting seeing patients one after the other. We're looking at cases and we have to stop what we're doing to go and change our mindset and things like that. So it's not something easy, but it's so meaningful. So with that, I'll open it for discussion. And I know Michigan does have a program where they can see patients. So if they want to share their experience, and if I have my colleagues have anything else to say.
That's really fantastic work. I'm really amazed about how you do this. Even though in Michigan we have that, but I unfortunately the problem is not participating in. I think our breast group is mainly doing the direct interaction with patients.
Well, if you have an opportunity, Tao, to do that, I would say, you know, I've met patients with lung cancer too. I mean, transplant is easy because everybody's happy, right? Usually it's new life, new opportunities. But even meeting with a cancer patient is a profound experience.
Yeah, I would agree. I would think about it to introduce that to the prominent group in here also.
Right. Okay, if there's no other comments, I could move on to the articles. My articles are pretty straightforward. I did that on purpose. The next one is this one here. So the next article I'm going to discuss is one where Andy Cherg is first author, and one of our former fellows, actually, Julia, is a senior on this one. And it's kind of the usual kind of a typical study distinguishing mesothelial benign mesothelial proliferation from mesothelioma now is becoming a little easier for us. We don't just have to rely on morphology. We do have BAP1, we have MTAP, and we have FISH for CDK and 2A. Now, the thing with the FISH for CDK and 2A, most of us, I would think, at least in our practice, we don't use the FISH, we use MTAP. And sometimes we forget that MTAP is just a surrogate. It's close, MTAP gene is close to the CDK and 2A, so it happens to be rearranged. Also, when CDNK2 gets lost, and that MTAP will get lost, but not always. So you can get CDKN2 loss without having MTAP loss. So that's why MTAP is really just a surrogate. It's about 80% of the cases of mesothelioma that have CDKN2 loss that will show MTAP loss. So because of that not perfect correlation and therefore not perfect sensitivity for MTAP and not Now, neither perfect sensitivity for BAP1 MTAP. And of course, with Merlin coming out, probably a better sensitivity overall. The authors wanted to explore using basically cish instead of fish, because their argument is cish is something that we as pathologists, we can assess ourselves. Usually fish is done in cytogenetics, special techniques, special microscope, techs that do the counting, etc. So the argument that cish is really like an IHC, and that therefore we as pathologists could use it much easier than we could do fish. But the question is cish identical to fish? And can you really substitute cish for fish? And so that was the purpose of their study. It was a small number of cases done on TMA. So they had a TMA that contained 20 mesotheliomas and 22 reactive mesothelial proliferation. They had two cores for each case as a duplicate. And MTAP was available in 24 of those mesotheliomas. So first, when they did their fish, the first thing they did is, because of course of the way you section and the way the nuclei might be positioned, you may get false positives. So you may have cells that look like they lose a signal. So it's a red and green signal, red for the centromere and green for the CDKN2 genes. And so the first thing they did is calculated, you know, how many cells can show a loss, quote unquote, of the green probe and within a normal, knowing, of course, you have to trust, and I do trust Andy to know and have really truly benign reactive versus mesothelioma, because that's the first thing. So what they did realize is that about, on average, about 11% of their normal mesothelial proliferation can have a loss of signal. So that was kind of a threshold that they had to call positive. And in fact, their threshold was higher than that. They assessed that usually a true loss, and those are the cases that had true loss, had signals in the 60s and 70s when the CDNK to fish was lost, so a high signal on average. And so based on that, their final finding was that they had five cases that were lost by fish of the CDKN2 gene, and those same five cases also showed loss by cish. So there was 100% concordance between the fish and the cish, but that's in five cases. And usually the cish, like I said, when it was deleted, more than 60% of the cells showed a loss of signal. And when they compared the cish to the MTAP across all 24 mesothelioma, there were four of the cases that had both a loss of MTAP and cish, so a perfect correlation of basically 80%, because they had one case that has cish loss but had MTAP retained. So it's kind of about what the literature shows, that it's about 80% of your cases that will have loss of CDKN2 and show a concordant loss of MTAP, but 20% of the time not. So I think I do sometimes, we're getting ready to get Merlin, I guess, going. I don't know how many of you have Merlin in your practice. So it will increase our sensitivity of detecting or feeling even more confident, especially on small samples, to make a call between malignant and benign. I don't know, Anya, how the immunolab would do cish, if you've ever done cish, if it's, I mean, it's more tedious because you do have to count cells. You have to find 100 cells and count the cells and count the loss of signals. So it's kind of counting mitosis in some ways. So I don't know how people feel about that. And if there's any comments or questions regarding the paper.
Yeah, I was curious. Is anyone doing cish? Because we don't. Like, no.
We don't do it. We have Merlin, though. I have not had a case yet where I've had Merlin loss with everything else retained.
Yeah, we also don't do this, but we do Merlin as well. I found Merlin to be a pretty good marker of mesothelial differentiation, but it can trip you up. You do have to be careful with it because there are other non-lung carcinomas that will stain positively for it. That's happened to me once or twice and been a little out of left field. So you have to be careful with Merlin, kind of get used to using it.
That's interesting. I know that our HemePath folks have used Cish in the past, I think. Anya, I don't know if you...
I don't think they have
anymore.
I mean, they use RNA scope, these kind of things, but Cish, I don't think we have a test right now.
Okay. So I guess we could wait to see for Merlin, but you know, I think at least there's an option out there if we really wanted to ramp up the sensitivity. At least this sounds like a viable option. So something to think about, I guess. Okay. If there's no other questions or comments about that one, I'm going to move on to immune checkpoint inhibitors, induced lung toxicity. This was led by Carol Farver and with colleagues out in Portugal. And the reason I chose this article is basically it kind of put together the little data we have on immune toxicity, immune checkpoint inhibitor toxicity in the lung. And in the summary, basically in the take-home messages, I listed the two other references on the topic. So right now we have a total of three references about these drugs and their toxicity in the lung. The first one was actually out of Scottsdale and published in 2019. And then there's one in 2021 by a Japanese group. And now there's this one. And and handfuls of patients, very few patients. And of course, as in this study, the biggest challenge comes from the fact that these patients are rarely just on checkpoint inhibitors alone. They're usually treated with radiation. They're usually treated with chemotherapy. And as we know, radiation and chemotherapy also induces toxicity to the lung. What they did, what the other two papers hadn't done, is really try to divide their cohorts to make a comparison of the histologic findings between three groups. So they did have a small group. It was a small group. It was two patients actually that only had immune checkpoint inhibitors compared to patients that had both chemotherapy and checkpoint inhibitors, which was 5, and radiation, which was a larger group, plus checkpoint inhibitors, which was 9. So they had a cohort of 12 patients, which is technically the largest cohort compared to the other two studies. But when you look at only the patients that had checkpoint inhibitors alone as monotherapy, it was still 2 patients. The other thing they did do a very exhaustive look at all the not just radiology, but they did a very exhaustive look at the histology, and they actually divided the histology in different compartments and thoroughly assessed each compartment. So they had the interstitial compartment, they had the alveolar space compartment, they had the pneumocytes compartment, they had the compartment that they call granuloma, which is not really a compartment, but anyway, other studies had mentioned granuloma, so they wanted to specifically study that. And I think they have nice illustrations of all the findings, very exhaustive pathology. Oh, and they had the airway compartment also. And really, this pretty much sums it up. So these are the different compartments they had. And there are three cohorts, and in red is when the finding was present, and in gray when the finding was not present, and the clear space is when they couldn't evaluate for that compartment. And I guess there's no surprise. There's nothing specific in terms of findings between the three groups. So one thing that they did found across all three groups, which was kind of interesting and not always really described well in other studies, is everybody had some interstitial thickening by a lymphocytic infiltrate. That was pretty much across all groups. The granulomas, which was a feature mentioned in other studies, small polyform granulomas, was not present in the two cases that were treated with checkpoint inhibitors alone, and actually not even in the chemo. I thought it would have been more common in the chemotherapy, but not. It seems like for whatever reason, it was a finding more common with the radiation group. Pneumocyte hyperplasia, atypia, vacuolization. Vacuolization had come up. Vacuolization of pneumocytes, vacuolization of the foamy histiocyte that also come up as a finding, maybe more common in checkpoint inhibitor toxicity, but in their study, it's something that they found across all groups, including and not just with checkpoint inhibitors. And then the question is, well, is it the checkpoint inhibitors, the presence of checkpoint inhibitors that causes the vacuolization and the foamy histiocytes to be seen in all the findings? Not clear if that's the case or not. So the other thing they looked at is that other studies hadn't done is to look at CD8 positive T cells and CD4 positive T cells and do a ratio. And what they found is that the CD8 positive T cells predominates across all groups in terms of the ratio. And that aligns with what is described in the literature, that CD8 positive T cells should be enhanced when you're giving checkpoint inhibitors. And that seems to be the case in these patients. They also looked at SP263 clone, assessing really the immune cells. They weren't looking at the tumor cells, but at the immune cells. These cases, the biopsies did not have tumor cells typically in them. But they only noticed that these immune cells had a decrease in frequency in the checkpoint inhibitors only group, which seems to suggest that it's better to have polytherapy because then you have more of the presentation of the gene during therapy. So that was their conclusion. So I think the take-home point is, I just thought this was an opportunity to put all the literature we have on checkpoint inhibitors together. No new findings. And just, I think, a confirmation. We always say, you know, our idiom is drug toxicity can cause any pattern of injury, and any pattern of injury can be caused by drug toxicity, whatever the drug is. And I think there's no differences with checkpoint inhibitors in this case. One of the shortcomings of this study that was well done in other studies is they didn't really go into saying that they had ruled out infection or had ruled out other things that could cause similar features, which the other two studies had done. And the findings are similar, so not sure that it played a big impact in their studies. So that's pretty much it for this article. So I don't know if there's any comments or questions. I guess not, unless I lost everybody. I don't have, I can't see everybody. So please let me know if you're there. still, at least.
Still here.
Okay, you're still there. You're still,
still here
there.
Too.
Perfect.
Yeah, okay. I think it's an unsurprising paper.
I'm at home because I'm part-time today, so my setup at home is not at, like at work, so I can't. The way I'm set up, I'm not seeing everybody, so I just want to make sure you're following me here. Okay. So if there's no questions and no comments, I'm going to move to my last paper that has no pathology, and I chose it mostly. It was a good reminder for me of things I know, but kind of tend to forget, and thinking it may become even more of importance, which is finding interstitial lung abnormalities or disease in our lung cancer patients. And I'm saying that just because I added this paper, not that I'm going to review it. It's a statement paper. You have it, but they kind of are linked together because also what has come out this year is a statement paper on how to approach these interstitial lung abnormalities that are found incidentally in patients. And how do you sort out what are benign, no clinical significance abnormalities that will go away versus early interstitial lung disease, which is really what the clinicians don't want to miss. And guess who are found to have these interstitial lung abnormalities the most often? Lung cancer patients, because high risk, of course, patients for lung cancer because of their age, smoking, etc., which are also a male, which are also the epidemiologic risk factors for interstitial lung disease. They undergo routine screening for lung cancer. And this paper really emphasizes that clinicians and radiologists that do have these patients that get routine screening for lung cancer, it's no longer, oh, fine, the patient does not have a lung nodule that we have to investigate. It's, oh, the patient doesn't have a lung nodule to investigate, but, oh, there's interstitial lung abnormalities, and now I have to investigate these interstitial lung abnormalities. And it also means for us that when we do lobectomies, well, we don't do the lobectomies. When the surgeons do lobectomies for lung cancers or potentially pneumonectomies, we also have to be, I think, more alert to the radiologic abnormalities beyond the lung cancer that these patients may have, because, of course, we need to investigate ourselves any additional lung abnormalities we may have in the lung. And I know Kelly, when she did our grand rounds with us, kind of made that point very nicely, that there's maybe more than one thing going on. And then the question, well, how often can we expect this to happen? And this is where this meta-analysis comes in. Because as you know, meta-analysis, the whole purpose of meta-analysis is to kind of search the literature and then kind of give us an overview of all the findings in the literature. So how often does it happen? And what is really the true impact on patients of finding these abnormalities? So they had very strict criteria of articles that they were to include in terms of articles that had any information on the incidence, prevalence of interstitial lung abnormalities / interstitial lung disease that had cancer, on which we had overall survival information, recurrence-free survival information, progressive-free survival information, complications to treatment. So they were looking for a lot of information that needed to be included in the articles that they would analyze. So basically, they started out with, it seemed like there was over 9,000, and this is, they went back to 2000 until 2024. So there was a lot of articles, over 9,000 articles that do mention in some capacity interstitial lung abnormalities and lung cancer, but not in the capacities that the authors wanted, such that at the end they only had 24 articles that were included, but it's still 24 good articles that had a lot of information for them to do their meta-analysis. And those 24 articles regrouped still, you know, over 7,000 patients. So a lot of patients were analyzed. And what they basically found, and they list, of course, all the articles that they looked at. So if you want to know more about each article, they're all listed. And of course, with meta-analysis, they do very extensive statistical analysis, which goes a lot much above my basic understanding of the usual statistics. But in all, what they did find in their different papers is that it's not uncommon to find interstitial lung abnormalities. And of course, they had imaging mostly. So about 17% of patients that are treated for lung cancer have some kind of interstitial lung abnormalities, mostly in the form of ground glass opacities, but a fair number with reticulation, which kind of implies a bit of some level of fibrosis. And it does have negative impact, not surprisingly. We know that from some of the pathology papers that are out there, that it does have a negative impact on patients. So they have a shorter overall survival, they have a worse progressive-free survival, a worse recurrence-free survivals. The odds ratio are not huge. The odds ratio are in the range of 1.8, 1.9. And of course, the worst are for the early stage lung cancer, which is not surprising because if you already have an advanced lung cancer and then you have interstitial lung disease with it, the effect of the interstitial lung disease on advanced lung cancer is not the same that if you have interstitial lung disease like a UIP with an early stage lung cancer, then the UIP will have much more impact on the overall prognosis of these patients. And the other thing, and the other importance of us noting these is also that patients that have interstitial lung disease and lung cancer and they undergo radiation or chemotherapy or immune checkpoint inhibitors also were found to have more complications. So their lungs are not good to start with, and so they're more susceptible to all of the drug toxicity impact that interstitial lung disease might confer to these patients. So for me personally, my take-home message is, you know, I kind of wax and wane. So when I'm out at the frozen section, you know, there are times where we're getting a lobectomy in a non-treated patients, which is becoming a little rarer. There's a lot of now neoadjuvant, of course, patients. I used to be much more rigorous, and I think I'm going to start being more rigorous again about looking at the CT scan and making sure that the radiologist hasn't described other abnormalities that might have gone unnoticed. Because if the patient gets through the oncologist surgeon route without being seen by pulmonologists, they might have kind of not paid as much attention to the abnormalities that they have to the lung cancer, which is what we have found sometimes. So, and to be more looking specifically for them in the lobectomy specimens and sampling, just to make sure to not miss them. So I guess I'm going to have to be more careful in my own personal practice. We do find them. Although I don't do the lung frozen section, and everybody does, a lot of people do the lung frozen section at our practice, I will be asked to see a case and they find fibrosis in the interstitium. And the question is, well, does it mean something? So sometimes it doesn't, sometimes it does. And that's part of what we have to do, I guess. So I don't know if there's any comments or thoughts about that in your personal experience.
First of all, I think, MC, it's a really great reminder for all of us. And then I was wondering, and you alluded to that too, did they actually go back to the CT scans and look at them again? Because I think this probably should be also an educational activity for surgeons before they actually do the lobectomy. Because sometimes I'm thinking, well, it's so extensive. Why didn't anyone see that? And the patient will die from the UIP and not from the stage one lung cancer.
Right. Well, this is a meta-analysis, so they're just analyzing other people's work. But I think this is an opportunity for us in our practice and also the way we educate our colleagues who do the frozen section and our fellows to be more aware of that, because then in our practice, we could certainly be more proactive of knowing how often they did see it and they still decided to proceed with the surgery, or they didn't see it. And it's good that they know about it, because especially if they're going to give additional treatment, clearly this meta-analysis also showed that these patients had a higher risk of developing complications related, lung complications, lung toxicity related to these drugs. Well, if there's no other comments, that's it for me today.
Thanks, MC, for a really nice selection of articles, and just congratulations to you and all your Mayo colleagues on the patient experience with transplant. That's really, really a Herculean effort and really, really puts pathologists out in the forefront. Appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. That's very kind of you. Thank you. Thank you all. And I don't think Anya wanted to talk with Henry, but I don't think Henry joined, did he? Today? No.
Looks okay. Like he's on.
Yeah,
now.
No, sorry. I was finally able to get on.
Okay. I don't know. I mean, I don't want anybody to feel bad, but this is Henry raised a question for the Mayo practice. So anybody who's not Mayo, you don't have to stay on for that conversation. But at the same time, if you want to stay on for that conversation, you're welcome, because Henry reached out to us regarding one of his, it was kind of I didn't talk about it because I put it, it's in the editorial section. It was kind of a letter to the editor, but it was a good, it was something that we need to be aware of, I guess. There's a lot of things in this journal club that we needed to be. There's good articles in this journal club just at large for awareness. But this is something that Henry, I could pull it up quickly. I think I can find my arrow.
I actually have to run in 2 minutes because I have the autopsy morning briefing.
Okay.
Yeah,
but
I've
basically, Henry, it was just about recuts for the cryobiopsies in interstitial lung disease. So
yeah.
How does it work in your practice? If you would, because you suggested on each cryobiopsy, we should get all these recuts. Now, how do you do that if you get tumors? Because I think many of our cryobiopsies are for tumors.
Tumor is a different question. That's an EBIS sample, and those we just get two cuts.
I know, but who sorts that out? Who sorts
it's based,
automatically get the recuts?
Tell you what, maybe we should have a separate meeting about this, because I can go through it, but not in 1 minute. And I've got a meeting at 7 as well.
Okay.
I would encourage people to read it's a short letter to the editor, because we often get slides from the outside with one. There's a lot of tissue in a cryobiopsy, and so we've put the current protocol that we're using. But for the Mayo folks, I think we need to schedule a separate meeting.
Okay. So
thanks.
Thank you, everybody.
Ciao.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.